Can I have your attention, please, everybody? Thank you for attending. This really is a landmark event here at Sheffield. We've got the world-renowned Israeli historian, Professor Ilan Pappe, here for the first time in a few years. Professor Pappe is a professor of history at Exeter University. He's the director of the European Centre for Palestine Studies. He's a well-known advocate for Palestinian rights and kicked up a lot of fuss with his book, The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine. I think he's in a competition with a few other people, but I think he's near the top of the list of one of the most hated men in Israel. One of the most loved men in Israel, depends on how you look at it. Without further ado, I think you've had enough of listening to me. It's Professor Ilan Pappe.
Good afternoon. It's a pleasure to be here. It's been almost 3 years since I've been here last time, and it's always a pleasure to come back to Sheffield. What I would like to do in the next 50 minutes is to ponder together with you about the meaning of the Nakba, the 1948 catastrophe. As always, around this time of year, around the 15th of May, all around the world, people who are Palestinians and people who care about Palestine stop doing what they're doing and try to figure out what happened back then in 1948 and what are the implications of what happened for the situation today. Because of the extraordinary circumstances in which the Nakba Day was commemorated this year on Israel's borders in the north, in the borders with Lebanon and Syria, and in the south, in the borders with the Gaza Strip. Because of that particular coincidence, for the first time the British press and the Western press took interest in the Nakba Day. I remember previous days, last year and the year before, it was impossible to interest anyone in the British media about that event. You needed unarmed Palestinians on the borders of Israel, and you needed 15 of them to be murdered by the Israeli soldiers so that the British press, at least for one day, would mention the Nakba Day. They even reached me in one of the interviews. And so typical to the Western press, they said the same thing again and again, not only in the interview with myself, but also with interviews with others or in their general commentary. And that's worth paying attention to. Even the more advanced broadsheet in this country, or the most more progressive media, electronic media, repeated the same phrase, and that phrase was, according to what the Palestinians see as a catastrophe. And I was also corrected by the interviewer again and again. You mean the way that the Palestinians see it as a catastrophe? At one point, I lost it, and I said, do you think that a forced dispossession of half of a country's population, a demolition of half of the country's villages, a destruction of half of the country's cities and towns, is not a catastrophe? What do you call it? A picnic? This is unbelievable. This is the only catastrophe in modern history that the British press insists on putting on quotation marks, is the Nakba. 63 years after, we still have to tolerate the idea that it's only according to the Palestinians, the dispossession of 1 million people, the massacres of thousands of Palestinians, is only according to the Palestinians a catastrophe. Namely, if you are just a decent human being in this country, it's not a catastrophe. It's a celebration, because that's what the Israelis are doing on the 15th of May. They have a day of celebration. And according to the Israeli law now, if you commemorate the day of celebration as a catastrophe, you can be sent to 3 years in prison because this is disallowed. Now, I didn't expect much of the Israeli government in this respect, but I'm surprised at the British media and its very biased approach to these events. So it means that we have a lot of work to do. It means that we should take it as a given that people in this country, even people who are interested in what goes on in Israel and Palestine, do not know what happened in 1948 and really think that there are two stories. One is an Israeli propaganda and one is a Palestinian propaganda. Imagine that you would have said to people that according to the Jews, there was a Holocaust in Europe. You would be either in jail in some European countries, and rightly so, or you would be silenced on the spot on British television, on radio. But you are not only allowed to say it about the Palestinian catastrophe, in fact, you are encouraged to use this relativist term by saying, yes, but only according to the Palestinians, massacres, ethnic cleansing, dispossession, and demolition is a catastrophe. According to everyone else, this is not a very important event and could be termed in different ways. So because of that, I'm motivated, although I always thought that I could take it for granted, I'm motivated even here this evening to first repeat what happened in 1948, so that when you encounter whoever you encounter, either your friends, your neighbors, Jewish students, Zionist members of the community in this nice town of Sheffield, whoever you encounter, and you are being encountered with this idea that, yes, according to the Palestinians, what happened is a catastrophe, you should be able to say, no, according to what happened, this is a catastrophe. This is very important, and don't take it for granted that this is how people see it. And again, I beseech you, see the Guardian of today, the Independent that, to its credit, one should say, at least devoted a leader today to the Nakba. Even the Independent and the leader says, according to what the Palestinians call a catastrophe. Right? So I beseech you to look at the newspapers, to look at the, to watch television, and to listen to the radio, and see how, in the rare moments when the Nakba is mentioned and commemorated, it's still brought up as one possible side of the story. And I think the best way to confront this, first and foremost, is to know exactly what happened. And that's the first thing I'll do tonight. Second thing, I would like to talk about the implications of what happened in 1948 to the history of Israel and Palestine ever since 1948. And finally, I would like to say something about the link between what happened in 1948 and the chances for peace and reconciliation in the future. In 1948, Israel committed a crime against humanity. This is not one possible explanation of what happened. This is according to the international law. Israel committed intentionally and systematically an ethnic cleansing operation. It tried to drive out all the people who were Palestinians from all the space that became the Jewish state, which was at the time 80% of historical Palestine, or if you want it in today's terms, Israel today without the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. This is a crime according to international law. This is a crime according to historical precedents before and after the event. And this is quite a classical case of ethnic cleansing, even according to the definition of the United Nations, of the United States State Department website. If you will look at the website of the State Department in the internet, you will see that they have an elaborated chapter on ethnic cleansing, because they dealt with the crime of ethnic cleansing during the Balkan Wars in the 1990s. So they developed a very clear notion of what ethnic cleansing is, and how should ethnic cleansers be treated. And if you just append the very simple facts of what happened on the ground in 1948, you will see that this is one of the starking, explicit cases of ethnic cleansing. And the International Court in The Hague has defined ethnic cleansing as a crime against humanity. So Israel committed, as a state, and before that, as a political movement, the Zionist movement, committed a crime against the Palestinian people. The crime consisted on driving out more than 700,000 Palestinians from their homes, demolishing half of Palestine's villages and destroying half of Palestine's towns and cities. You have to understand that it's not just the absolute numbers which convey the magnitude of the catastrophe. It's actually the relative numbers. In other words, the fact that the people who were driven out were half of Palestine's population. Imagine any country you live in, whether it's Britain or if you come from another country, imagine an event after the Second World War where half of a country's known population is being driven out in less than 9 months. And then imagine that 60 years later, a journalist will ask you, yes, according to you, this is a catastrophe. Right? Unbelievable. Incredible. Because people did not always accept the Israeli expulsion orders, did not always give in to the pressure to leave, because in some cases they resisted, the ethnic cleansing was accompanied by many cases of massacres and rapes. So it's not just the expulsion, it's not just the demolition, it's not just the destruction, it's also the massacres. But that's not where the 48 events end, and this is not the only part of the event that we should commemorate every year and remind ourselves, even if there are those who try to deny it and make us forget what happened. On the ruins of the villages, of the towns, of any space where Palestinians lived, the Israelis build a new reality. They build new settlements or planted trees for recreational grounds so as to make Palestine as we knew it disappear for the consciousness and memory of people around the world. Quite cynically, in quite few cases, the new Jewish settlement carried a very similar name to the Palestinian village. The reason being an Israeli attempt to say that actually this was always an ancient Hebrew settlement. And that's why actually the Palestinian name was a Hebrewized version of an ancient biblical site, which of course was nonsense. But when you talk about nonsense, you need archaeologists to verify it as a scientific truth. And the Israeli archaeologists are the best at this in the world. They recruit themselves in 5 minutes, either in the occupied West Bank or after the 48 war, to give you any scientific evidence you want to make, to concoct the story that these villages were 2,000 years ago Hebrew sites of a sort. You don't have to be an experienced archaeologist to understand that they knew the results of their inquiry long before they started the digging. And in some cases, did not even bother to dig. They just looked at the place and said, of course, this is the place where the Bible says Abraham walked or David strolled. The problem of any ethnic cleansing operation, as different, for instance, from genocide operation, is that it's never complete. You never complete it. Especially when, in this case, the ethnic cleanser was a young state, not a large number of people lived in that state. It had limited military capacity. As the ethnic cleansing operations continued, the local Palestinians resisted it more and more. And eventually even the international community, although it was very reluctant to stop the ethnic cleansing operation after the Holocaust, even the international community at one point intervened, and the ethnic cleansing operations stopped before the whole of Israel was cleansed from its Palestinian population. So a small number of Palestinians remained within the state of Israel. As you know, they are today the Arab citizens, as the Israelis call them, the Arab citizens of Israel, or as they call themselves, the Palestinian citizens or Palestinian minority inside Israel. Because the world decided to be silent, although its leaders, its diplomats, its journalists, its academics knew exactly what was happening on the ground in 1948, because the world decided to be silent, the young state of Israel has received a very important global message. And that message was that Israel can claim to do two things. One, it can claim to represent the Jewish victims and survivors of the Holocaust, despite the fact there were many Jewish organizations and many Jewish survivors who did not accept Israel's right to represent them. And nonetheless, the international community gave Israel the right to be the ultimate, exclusive representative of the Holocaust. And that's very important because it meant, it granted Israel immunity from any serious Western criticism, at least official governmental Western criticism. To this very day, Israel is immune from such criticism. I'm talking about governmental criticism, political elites criticism, not from sections in the public, which of course have changed their minds about Israel and are critical of what goes on there. The second thing, or second decision, was to allow Israel, or to give Israel immunity as long as its policies are not, if you want, dramatic or drastic, or as one brave Israeli journalist has put it, who died a few years ago, Arya Kaspi, Haaretz journalist, who used to say, as long as Israel doesn't do to the Palestinians exactly what the Nazis did to the Jews, Israel is exonerated. And again, I'm not talking about demonstrations by angry students or sections of the public. I'm talking about the people who matter in international politics, at least until today. Governments, mainstream media, and other powerful sections of the society. This immunity for Israel's impunity in the name of the Holocaust was an inevitable consequence of, or inevitable reading of the way the world remained silent during the ethnic cleansing of Palestine in 1948. And when Palestinian historians and activists were trying to publish memoirs, trying to raise the world's consciousness immediately after 1948, they were treated as people who are spreading propaganda and who are the new anti-Semites or anti-Jewish representatives in the globe, rather than victims of the crime against humanity that took place in 1948. But there was another consequence for the way that the world accepted the ethnic cleansing of Palestine as a legitimate act. And that consequence had to do with the fact that it's not only that Israel was not brought to justice. Not only did the world remain silent, Israel was treated as the only democracy in the Middle East. In fact, a state that on its very foundation, or the very day it was founded, has committed a crime against humanity, was immediately granted an exceptional position that no other country in the Middle East has ever received. And that is, you are a member of the group of civilized nations, as the Americans would like to put it in those days. Namely, you are part of the West, like Australia, like New Zealand. And no other country in the Middle East has ever received that kind of adjective or praise. Now, of course, these praises are not symbolic. They are immediately translated into political clout, into economic finance and help, and total immunity, because the Western superpowers will automatically support you, whether it is diplomatically, militarily, or economically. Again, you have to understand that this exceptional position was granted on the last day of the completion of the ethnic cleansing. It was that bad in a way in terms of historical timing and periodization. And because of that, the idea that you have to maintain the ethnic purity of Israel, if you want the ethnic supremacy of Israel, and not to be worried that while you do it, you would lose that position of the only democracy in the Middle East, became the main ideological infrastructure for the Israeli policies in the future. If you want to understand it better, think about the opposite example, which is apartheid South Africa. Apartheid South Africa tried to say, we are a democracy, but we're racist. And for a while, it worked, as you know. Incidentally, as you probably all know, apartheid was institutionalized as a regime, an official regime in South Africa in 1948. It took a while for the Western elites, political elites and governments to say, no, this doesn't work. This, you cannot be both a member of the West, if you want, and maintain a racist regime. Well, you cannot do it, especially when the Cold War is over. You could do it while the Cold War was going on, as long as you promised to be on the right side of the Cold War. But Israel found out that it's not the Cold War that gave it its particular position. It was far more sophisticated than that. If you want, it was more profound than that. And that's why when the Cold War was over, nothing changed in the immunity given by the West to Israel's ethnic cleansing ideology and strategy. So it became an integral part of the constitution of the state, of its ideology, of its dominate and hegemonic discourses. In other words, you can go even today and you'll see young Israelis speaking about themselves as being Democrats and anti-Arabs. And they really, whether they are full professors in the universities or students in a high school, they really think that the idea that Israel should maintain ethnic purity at all cost is not antagonistic to the idea of a democracy. Because this is the global message. This is not just the internal message. This is the global message. They know it. Wherever they go, the only democracy in the Middle East is Israel. And when they come back to Israel, they know how legitimate it is to think about Israel as a place where you are entitled, you are even encouraged to think in terms of ethnic purity, supremacy. And all you have to do is replace the word ethnic with race or racist. And you will see that actually in the United States, where nobody uses ethnic ethnicity as a term, but rather race. They alternate in America between race and ethnicity, that actually if we ever succeed in penetrating the American kind of immunity shield given to Israel, most American will talk about Israel as a racist state. But of course, this is not going to happen too soon. On a practical level, the fact that on the one hand, the ethnic cleansing was not completed, and on the other hand, the world continued to justify the idea of a Jewish democracy as being a democratic idea, as a progressive idea, brought Israel other problems. In 1967, when Israel occupied the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, it faced a serious dilemma. On the one hand, it succeeded in occupying those parts of Palestine it failed to occupy in 1948, namely the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. On the other hand, it incorporated what was then 1.5 million Palestinians, who are now 3.5 million Palestinians. So they kicked out almost 1 million Palestinians in 1948, but in 67, they incorporated again the same number, or even a larger number of Palestinians. So if you still believed, as most, and this is a consensual Zionist idea, that you cannot survive unless you have a purely ethnic Jewish state, by enlarging the number of Palestinians in your own state, you create new problems. And you worked hard in 1948 to diminish the problem. Again, this twin realities, that on the one hand, your own domestic ideology is you are entitled to put the idea of ethnic purity or supremacy above any other value, and that the world accepts it and would still retain you in this very prestigious community of civilized nations. These twin realities also explain the Israeli strategy ever since 1967. And the idea was the following. One option was to get rid of the Palestinians in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. I mean, after all, Israel did it in 1948. Why not do it in 1967? But then it turned out that the war was too short, if you want, that the feeling among the Israeli policymakers was that the Palestinians would not, it would be even more difficult to drive them out twice. As you know, probably, many of the residents of the West Bank and the Gaza Strip were 1948 refugees. So these refugees would probably resist much more than the 48 refugees. And this is the age already of television. And the Israeli government was worried that any dramatic, massive expulsion would be much more visible in the eyes of the world than were the 48 ethnic cleansing operation. So this was ruled out. Not that people were not expelled. Israel, as you know, Israel substituted the massive ethnic cleansing with an incremental ethnic cleansing, with a much more piecemeal ethnic cleansing, gradual ethnic cleansing. In between 67 and 1994, the official Israeli number is for 150,000 Palestinians who were expelled just by the method of telling anyone who left the West Bank or the Gaza Strip for more than 3 years that they could not come back. This is 150,000. It was an amazing, it was a big headline in Haaretz when this document was exposed, as if the Palestinians who were expelled never knew that they were expelled. They needed the Israeli document to know that they were not allowed to come back. But this does not include the hundreds of thousands of Palestinians who were expelled after 67, almost 300,000. But yet, given the numbers, 1.5 million and later 3 million, this is not a massive expulsion compared to 1940. So you cannot expel the Palestinians. Can you grant them citizenship? No, you can't, because you need to be a purely ethnic state. Right? And the world says, yeah, pure ethnic state, this is democracy, isn't it? I mean, that people who are one race and ethnicity have more rights than others. That's democracy. That's what you all read in your textbooks on democracy, isn't it? So you couldn't give them citizenship. You could, of course, leave the territories and give them a state, but you couldn't do that. I mean, you cannot allow the Palestinians to have a state in what you deem to be the ancient land of Israel, or even if you're not such a romantic nationalist, you can't trust the Palestinians to have a state in the midst of what you consider to be Israel. So what do you do if you cannot expel, you cannot grant citizenship, and you cannot give them independence? What do? You invent the peace process. And rightly so, some of you are even getting the Nobel Prize for inventing the peace process. A diplomatic effort that has nothing to do with the reality on the ground. Of course, it wouldn't work without some Palestinians helping you. It wouldn't work without some rotten, corrupt Arab regimes legitimizing it. And it wouldn't help without the Western world saying, great, we love it. This looks so political scientist. This looks like a scientific solution to the problem. And you make sure that the peace process gets nowhere. And that many, many people can live out of it. Because then you create a kind of an industry. So the peace process becomes an industry. And the more it becomes an industry, it becomes a corporation. And like all corporation, it becomes global. And like all corporation, it has nothing to do with the benefit and welfare of those who work for the corporation. Only those who manage the corporation make profits out of it. And that's why there is an amazing kind of discrepancy between what is being discussed in the various, I won't mention them, in the various stops that this peace train is visiting in its trip to nowhere, and the reality on the ground. And the one thing the Israelis are really worried about is the end of the peace process. So even, because that's when really people would start asking, what should we do with what's going on the ground? And every now and then you have new illuminaries who revive the dead body of the peace process. It's like Tony Blair, whose appointment to, as I always comment, appointing him to take care of the peace process is like appointing Dracula to head the blood bank. This peace process allowed Israel to expand the colonization of the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, to pursue a policy of collective punishment and assassination whenever Palestinians resisted, either by force or non-violently, the occupation. And if you look back at that short history since 1967, you will find out something very interesting. Because there is a total consensus between the left Zionist parties and the right-wing Zionist parties that the West Bank and the Gaza Strip should be part of Israel. But there are tactical discussions about what does it mean. The left says you can rule it indirectly. You can subcontract the rule to a Palestinian authority. You can find someone to do it for you. The right wing says, no, you have to directly control it. But in essence, it's the same idea. It's yours. It should be under your control. And by that, you solve the issue of not expelling and not granting citizenship. But there's an interesting issue. The left also in Israel portrays itself, as the years go by, as the champion of the process. And the right wing says, we are a little bit against the process. So what happens is that when the left wing is in government, there is a lot of activity around the process. What does it mean in reality? More settlements, more expulsions, more annexation. When the right wing is in power, there is less of a process and less annexations and less settlement. You can look at it. During the Labour Party reign in power in Israel, more new settlements were built. More land was expropriated. More Palestinians went into prison. When the Likud is in power, it is halved. Why? Because they don't talk so much about the peace process. So the very nice American diplomats in the American consulate in East Jerusalem have to leave the comfort zone and at least look from Ramallah onwards to see whether there are new settlements. When there is a peace process, they don't go. There's no need because there's a peace process, so there couldn't be any settlements during the peace process, right? But then when there's no peace process, when Netanyahu is in power, suddenly they have to report back to the State Department what did they see in the West Bank, right? So when they are on the field, the Israelis try to curb the settlement zeal and colonization zeal. So if you start on the 48, the ethnic cleansing, and you go to the policy pursued from 67 onwards, you can see a very elaborate and sophisticated Israeli attempt to complete the ethnic cleansing of 1948 through all kinds of means, including the peace process. And because of that, it could have never provided a basis, the peace process, I mean, could have never produced, I'm sorry, a genuine reconciliation. It was never meant to reconcile between the two sides. It was just meant to provide Israel an umbrella to find the best way of remaining a democracy, a racist state, and a stabilized state. And then came the last year with the Arab Spring, revolutions, instability, the crisis in America, and suddenly the Israelis feel that this very impressive kind of enterprise that they have erected is under danger of collapsing. You can maintain this ethnic state when Mubarak is in power. Can you maintain it when democratic Egyptian forces are in power? You can maintain it even when Bashar al-Assad is in power. In fact, you need few Arab rulers who are anti-Israeli. It's good. It's good for getting many weapons from America. And every now and then, if you are not sure that the Israelis are frightened enough to tell them that there are thousands and thousands of missiles and nuclear bombs and so on, to make sure that the dormant fear of annihilation can be awoken. You can't do it with Mubarak. You cannot frighten you couldn't frighten the Israelis with Mubarak. He looked too much as a member of the Zionist Federation. But you can do it with Bashar Assad. Definitely you can do it with Hassan Nasrallah. I mean, he looks frightening for the Israelis on television. So you could do this. But even that is not going to work anymore. So they are under real, seriously speaking, they are under real pressure in Israel, as they have never been for years. And I think part of it is the fact that the civil society in the West is not buying anymore the formula of an ethnic democratic state. You can be either a democratic state or you can be an ethnic state. You can't be both. And we don't support racist states. We want to see democratic states. So they're losing the social support or the society support. They are not losing yet the Western political elite support, that's true. And they are not losing the Americans' administration support, that's also true. But suddenly, you know, it's like, think about a bridge that is sort of hanging over a river. And there are many kind of chains that hold this bridge. 10 of them. Imagine being in the middle of the bridge with your car, and someone comes and says to you politely, excuse me, are you aware that 5 out of the 10 chains have broken? Just go on driving, but do take into account. This is how Israelis feel today. It's true that they think that the most important chains are still there, which is the United States and Western government. But then they say to themselves, if so many other things have changed, maybe this could change too. Now, this is a very dangerous moment, and with this I will end because I want to have enough time to discuss with you whatever you want to discuss. This is a very dangerous moment because, in an absurd, macabre way, as long as the Israelis were convinced that the peace process was working, that all these chains and supportive devices are in place, they pursued a brutal policy towards the Palestinians, but one which we were familiar with. Again, being on the receiving end of that policy was terrible, I'm sure. But it could get worse. In other words, they limited themselves to the massive political imprisonment, incremental colonization, every now and then retaliation. But there was kind of a steady aspect to that policy. When you are under pressure, and we've seen it in the last days of the apartheid regime in South Africa, there's a danger that the policy becomes more fanatic, brutal, and lethal. And I'm afraid what we have seen in Gaza in January 2009 is a precursor of such a potential. It can be stopped, of course. Nothing is inevitable. It can be stopped. It's surprisingly, the much more than in the case of Libya or in Syria, the Western world holds the keys for preventing another catastrophe that this time will also hit the Jews in Israel, not just the Palestinians. They hold the keys much more than they hold the keys for changing the realities in Libya. After all, Israel is not an Arab country, so they don't have to bomb and they don't have to use their army. They seem to have this inclination in the United States and Britain. They need to bomb an Arab country every few years. Otherwise, there's no foreign policy. There's no national security agenda. Did you notice? Every few years, doesn't matter what the circumstances is, one poor Arab country has to be bombed. The main reason I always suspect is that you have these new fighter jets and you don't know how they really are in practice. And no, they won't use, I don't mean that they should use that on Israel. They don't need to. They really don't need to. There is, after all, this is a community of settlers, a third generation of settlers who really want to be part of the Western world. They insist on being in the Eurovision. They're not doing too well. They insist on being in the European Football League. They're not doing too well. But nevertheless, they want to have this dream of having an earthquake that would separate them from the Middle East and append them to Italy or whatever. So they are really, can be easily molded by the Americans and the Western powers for the sake of their own people, not just for the sake of the victims. Finally, I think that we are reaching that moment. The only problem is that I'm not sure what would be the scenario, whether we will have this terrible scenario where the Israelis go bizarre and mad. And I like the Iranians, they do have nuclear weapons. Or that the West will wake up in the last moment and say, wait a minute, it's not worth it. It's not worth destabilizing the whole world when there is an equitable, just solution for the problem of Palestine that would incorporate the Jews, the immigrants who came to Israel, the Palestinian refugees. It's not such a complicated solution. We're talking about 14 million people. You don't have to solve the problem of 1 billion people here. And it's not a large space that you have to settle. It's actually quite basic. So one hopes that the better scenario would emerge, the scenario where the West says, wait a minute, this is not worth it. And the time is reaching, because in September, after the declaration in the United Nations, which the Americans are going to boycott, we will all be invited, be prepared. We are all going to be invited to a funeral. And the deceased would be the two-state solution. And I don't know how long we're going to mourn it. If we are Jews, we'll sit for a week. If we are Muslims, we'll sit for 40 days. If we are Christians, we'll just eat and eat and eat until the food is gone. But whatever we do, or we are Buddhists, we'll cremate the two-state solution. But whatever we do, we will have to think together, Palestinians and Israelis and other people, what do we do next? Because whatever happens after September, it will be clear that when the United Nations acknowledges the two-state solution, the Americans support it, the West supports it, and there is no chance in the world that will ever be implemented, I think that's when people would declare that the two-state solution is dead for all intents and purposes. It's already dead. It's like Ariel Sharon. It's been for years in coma, and nobody took it too seriously. It's dead. Now the question is, what do we do afterwards? What do we do afterwards? And none of the things that we are doing now have a good answer to this. It is important to continue the boycott and divestment and sanctions campaign against Israel, because that's the only thing that, for the time being, averts the next catastrophe. It's important to support all the efforts on the Palestinian side for unity and for solving the issues of representations. But these are all preliminary stages for the real question. How would the people who live there now, and how would the refugees who used to live there, find a way of living together in the future? Right? And we have to think jointly of a one-state solution and find the best way for doing it. One thing is clear, that this one state has to be the utter opposite of the ethnic and racist state of Israel. Thank you.